Several years ago, I gave a message entitled The Seven Bewares of Christ. And at that time, we went through the seven times when Jesus Christ issued a warning by saying the words, beware of. And he went on then to describe his concern for our well-being. And the seven bewares uttered by Christ are, beware of false prophets, beware of men, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees, beware of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees, beware of the leaven of Herod, number 6, beware of the scribes, and number 7, beware of covetousness. Now, Jesus Christ was not the only one to warn the members of the New Testament Church of God of the challenges before them. Jesus Christ told his disciples to follow his example. In John 12:26, he said, if anyone serves me, he must follow me, and where I am, there will my servant be also. And if anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. Well, notice this term of the use of the term anyone. That means us. So if we serve Christ, then we have to follow his example. And so Jesus Christ issued the bewares, which are really warnings. Now, we're used to warnings in life. We grew up as little kids, toddlers, and what did we hear? Our parents warned us about various things. We soon learned about gravity all on our own. Tried to walk, crash, boom. That didn't feel good. We tried it again. And our parents would warn us, don't touch the hot stove. What did we do? Probably had to burn ourselves a time or two. Or have you seen adults with the sign that says, wet paint, don't touch, and they all go over and touch the wet paint to see if it's really wet. So you have warnings. You see them on the highway, warning signs about slow down or minimum speed on a freeway, perhaps dead-end road, four-way stop ahead. And so a variety of warnings it has there. And we have warnings all around us in life, and the warnings aren't there just to hurt us, to make life difficult for us. The warnings are there to prevent something bad from happening so that we can enjoy the fullness of life. Well, Jesus Christ, in John 10:11, and again in John 10:14, twice referred to himself as a good shepherd. He said simply, I am the good shepherd. Well, in his capacity as a good shepherd, Jesus Christ issued warnings. He warned his flock, the called out ones, the members of God's church who were called by God the Father, responded to the calling. And Jesus Christ showed his love for his people by issuing these cautionary statements because he loved them. And the apostles, the sent out ones that Jesus Christ sent out, apostle means sent out, they followed the example of Christ by being then good shepherds themselves. And by showing the care for their flock, then they showed care for the church that Jesus Christ had entrusted to them. And in John 21, in verses 15 through 17, we have the scenario where Jesus was talking to Simon Peter about, do you love me? Yes. Feed my lambs. Tend my sheep. Do you love me? Yes. Well, then the third time, feed my sheep. It was a continuing pattern that Jesus Christ said to feed my sheep. So the disciples of Christ became apostles. First, they were disciples, and then they became apostles. They were sent out, and they took up the responsibilities that Jesus Christ placed upon them to feed the spiritual sheep and to care for those who responded to the calls by God to become members of the God family. But today, I'm going to cover a close subject. It's called the seven warnings of the apostles. I just referred to the seven warnings of Jesus Christ. Well, I'm going to talk about the following the footsteps of Jesus Christ, that the apostles issued warnings or cautions to the followers of Christ. And seven times the apostles uttered the words, beware of, and then proceeded to explain their concerns. So the title of the message is, The Seven Warnings by the Apostles. The first warning that we come across is in Acts 13:40. The first warning is, beware of what the prophets are saying. That sounds a lot like somebody saying, better listen to your mother, or whatever. So listen to what somebody is saying in Acts 13:40. Beware, therefore, lest that come upon you, which is spoken of in the prophets. Whoa. So be warned. If you don't follow what you should do, you could suffer the results of what the prophets said. The next verse in Acts 13, then in verse 41, it quotes the prophet Habakkuk. Probably not a lot quoted scriptures on Habakkuk, but let's go to Habakkuk 1:5. It says in Habakkuk 1:5, it's referred to in Acts, look among the nations and watch. Then it says, be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe though it were told you. Here we're hearing that Paul was preaching to and quoting to the Jews in the synagogue in Antioch. If we look on those previous verses, and he was referring to resurrection from the dead and salvation from eternal death. And the warning he was giving to the Jews was mocked. Even though Paul recounted his sermon, the history of Israel's failure to follow God. It was after the Jews had mocked and derided Paul, and then they blasphemed, that Paul uttered then the words in verse 40 about being utterly astounded. Beware therefore, lest what has been spoken in the prophets come upon you. Verse 41, behold, you despisers, marvel and perish, for I work a work in your days, a work which you will by no means believe, though were one were to declare it to you. In other words, even if I told you, you wouldn't believe it. It's going to happen. It's going to be a... So the Apostle Paul had evidently knew these verses. He had must have been studying, as I've mentioned, his ABC scripture memory cards, in order to come up with this while he was being mocked, and says, this verse in Habakkuk, boom. Well, that means he had to have read it, had to have remembered it, and then recounted Old Testament examples where Israel didn't heed the warnings of the prophets. Ultimately, we know that God divorced Israel, and all of the tribes of Israel, including Judah, were overrun by their enemies, and they were hauled away as captives. In Jeremiah 3:8, the prophet Jeremiah writes, in Jeremiah 3:8, then I saw that for all the causes for which backsliding Israel had committed adultery, I had her put away and gave her a certificate of divorce, yet her treacherous sister Judah did not fear, but went and played the harlot also. Well, the behavior of the children of Israel, and including Judah, that it was so bad that eventually all of the tribes of Israel went into captivity. The northern tribes were carried off by Assyria, and the southern kingdom was taken captive by Babylon. But the Apostle Paul wasn't the only one to issue a warning. Jesus Christ issued or established a new covenant with spiritual Israel, and under that new covenant urged Christians to be watchful of the things to come. And if we read in Matthew 24, it's an entire end time prophecy that Jesus laid out regarding the end times. And if we start in Matthew 24 and starting in verse 32, he gives the parable of the fig tree and how you can tell when spring is near. Well, the fig starts producing or putting out the figs. Go down to verse 42. It says, watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Verse 44, therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you don't expect. Well, we're to be ready. To do that, we have to be watchful, just as the owner of a house watches over it to protect it, so he's prepared and not caught by surprise. We don't want to be caught by surprise. We also want to watch. And then to do that, you follow what the prophets are saying. You want to see the road signs. You want to know what's coming. Luke 21:34 records it this way. and Luke 21:34. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, the cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all those things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Well, just as ancient Israel came to a terrible fate because they weren't mindful of what the prophets of God told them, we are then warned to what the prophets are saying about our future. You might think of this as like watching the weather forecast. What's going to happen? Are you going to be surprised? And sure enough, when we have a bad weather forecast, what happens in the stores? They buy out the water, they buy out the bread, and all the other basics, and you can't get eggs anyway. But they have, you know, just buying everything that they can, and we always go there on the day before the storm. Well, we don't go there on the day, but if we did, the parking lots are full because people are beware of what the weather forecast says. Yet they don't take the same heed to what the prophet said about the forecast for their own nation. So the first point of the bewares of the apostles is in Acts 13:40, beware of what the prophets are saying. So there's a warning. We should study the prophets, know what prophecy is about. The second warning by the apostles, this is an interesting one, in Philippians 3:2, and I'm going to parse this out, beware of dogs. Well, that's interesting. I mean, any of you that have had a dog story, you know, it comes as a challenge. As a kid, I rode a bicycle over to the neighbor's and the farm, riding on a gravel road. I did not expect that the neighbor would have a mean dog. It was a German Shepherd. It was protecting. I just drove by the driveway. I was a little kid on a bicycle. I never saw a dog jump so high before, when it was jumping up, looking me in the eye and barking like it was going to tear my liver out. So I bicycled home in a big hurry, and the dog kept up with me quite a bit of the way. So when I think of beware of dogs, I know what they're talking about. Now, and everybody probably has a beware of dog story somewhere along the way. I mean, I grew up very positive a relationship with a dog. Got one when I was in first grade in country school. My brother and I surprised our parents and brought home a 6-month border collie that the teacher brought to school. It was only a mile away. We walked home, had this wonderful young dog. Well, of course we need a dog. Ours died last winter and it's spring. And sure, my parents weren't real happy, but we were just delighted that we had this dog. We didn't know the difference because we were first and second grade. We didn't know. We'd never gone to boy-girl school, so we didn't know, you know, the difference between boy and girl dogs. I came to find out that we had a girl dog, and girl dogs have puppies. The parents were not too pleased at that thought, but that's the way it was. But you know, that dog was a wonderful cattle dog. We had livestock on the farm. She would come with a nod or a whistle. She was a constant companion. She was our best friend. In fact, when my brothers and I were all in our 40s, my parents had 4 boys in 5 years, we're all in our 40s and we're comparing notes, and we all thought the dog was our best friend. We never discussed it. We just naturally assumed it, that it was such a close relationship. I mean, the dog would ride in the pickup with us, would ride around on the farm, jump on the hay rack. And I never even thought about it making such an impact on my life. It wasn't a mean dog. Now, it would bark and bark at strangers because she took her job seriously as the farm dog. But she didn't attack anyone. So I grew up with a favorable impression of dogs, at least our dog. But a neighbor dog, now that was something different. So you have this beware of dogs. Now I have a mixed message here. Well, what can this mean? Well, the mixed message is he really talking what Paul meant? Was he really talking about the dog as we read in the dictionary, the four-legged animal? And if we take a look at the meaning of dogs in Strong's Exhaustive Concordance, in Strong's Greek word 2965, and the word number one definition is, surprise, surprise, a dog. A dog is a dog. And the second meaning is, it's metaphorical. A man of impure mind an impudent man. So the second definition puts the biblical warning into perspective. A man of impure mind or an impudent man, one who doesn't make good decisions or is arrogant. Those who don't follow the truth, who willingly believe and practice a lie, who are willing to inflict then their bad decisions on others. So they were called a dog. Now, Jesus Christ used the same metaphorical expression about dogs, not about the little four-legged creature that was mankind's best friend, but it was the metaphorical definition. In Matthew 7, verse 6, Jesus said, "Do not give dogs what is holy. Do not throw your pearls before pigs, lest they trample them underfoot and turn to attack you." Well, Matthew Henry's commentary explains it this way. This is a rule to all in giving reproof. Our zeal against sin must be guided by discretion. We have to make good choices. And we must not go about to give instructions, counsel, and rebuke, much less comfort, to hardened scorners, to whom it will certainly do no good, but to who will be exasperated and enraged at us. Throw a pearl at a swine, and the swine will resent it as if you threw a stone at him. Reproofs will be called reproaches, as they were in Luke 11 and Jeremiah 6. Therefore, don't give to dogs and swine holy things. So there's using good decisions about when you should put the truth or the pearls before those who would value it. Now, this is particularly true, and I had this occasion this morning on a funeral or memorial service. How much of the truth should you share? Should you take an axe, split open their skull, and pour the knowledge right into their brain and say, "Take this. This is the truth. Walk you in it"? Or is there a more gentle and a better way? So you have to use discretion in order to be able to explain the truth in a way that they would receive it. It's said that you can catch more flies with honey than vinegar, and this may have something to do with it here in this. So if we take a look here about who gets trampled, and we have the story of, and it's interesting, that of the mischief or the contempt expected from the metaphorical dogs and swine, you can expect that they will just ridicule it, and they will scorn the truth and rage against it, and they will turn against the person who is saying something. Just take a look at the example of John the Baptist. He told the truth to Herod. And what happened? It was kind of awkward, if you would call being beheaded kind of awkward. Okay, it was a very awkward situation, and Herod's daughter asked for John's head on a platter, or his stepdaughter did. So we've got to be able to distinguish what to say and when to say it. So there's a warning here about the dogs. Now, there's other scriptures about dogs, and we can tell that the use of the scripture is not the dogs of the canine variety or like wolves, but the definition of a man with an impure mind. We take a look at Revelation 22 in verse 15. I'm reading this in the English Standard Version. "Outside are dogs and sorcerers and the sexually immoral and murderers and idolaters and everyone who loves and practices falsehood." Well, what does it mean, dogs and sorcerers? And outside of what? Well, Thayer's lexicon explains the term "outside" means outside the Christian church. So the behavior listed in Revelation 22 is practiced outside the church, not inside the church. So the dogs, the men of impure minds, are grouped together with those who choose to worship other gods and practice immorality, and those who love and practice falsehood. So the verse in Revelation 22 is a pretty strong statement of warning, especially the closing phrase, "everyone who loves and practices falsehood." Now, there's an old proverb that says, "Let sleeping dogs lie." And this is often said in the legal profession, you don't want to walk over and kick a dog and wake it up and see if it's mean and will bite you. Well, we don't want to get close to a vicious dog, sleeping or not. And we're best served then by being careful around people who have impure minds. It doesn't really matter if they're comedians or even geniuses in their field. But if they're impure, they have impure minds, we have to be very careful around them. Perhaps you've seen pictures of what I've heard it colloquially is called a Mexican lion. Now, you may have seen a junkyard dog. It's a long, shaggy, yellowish-haired dog, but they close-clip all the hair except on the head and the shoulders area. Well, what happens then, the big yellow dog looks like a lion because the front part is all shaggy and the rest is all close-clipped. And it's so if a thief sneaks into the junkyard, he's already kind of nervous because he's a thief, with the intent then to steal auto parts, he might come face-to-face with a dog that at first glance looks like a lion. And clipping the hair then on the large dog resembles a lion was meant to scare off the would-be thief before he attempts to steal anything. That's not what Paul is talking about in his warning to beware of dogs. The beware of dogs, and I'm point two, a beware of dogs, a man of impure mind, is an impudent man who scorns God. So that's the third warning, is beware of dogs, the impure mind. The third warning, given by the apostles is in Philippians 3:2. And this is the same verse as the second point, but we're going on in the verse in Philippians 3:2. It says, beware of evil workers. Whoa, well, that's interesting. What's an evil worker? Guy who runs a caterpillar and he pushes down the wrong tree? Oops, no, that doesn't sound right. We look at Strong's definition of evil. In G 2556, in Strong's Concordance, Greek word 2556, it says, of a bad nature, not such as it ought to be, of a mode of thinking, feeling, or acting, base, wrong, wicked, troublesome, injurious, pernicious, destructive, baneful. So that's evil, of a bad nature, pretty well sounds like it. And then let's take a look at the word workers. In Strong's G2040, a worker or a laborer, one who works for hire, one who does something or perpetrates some kind of work. Thayer's lexicon explains that a worker is one who gets paid for what they do. So what does it say? Beware of evil workers here in Philippians. So what are those evil workers? Those who choose to go up against God, who deliberately spurn the truths of God, and they make their living by doing or preaching the things that are wrong in God's sight. To find examples of evil workers, all we have to do is turn on the television, go to a movie, listen to a certain kind of music, or perhaps listen to some politicians. It won't take long before we're bombarded with attempts to draw us away from God's way of life. You'll notice that Strong's definition number two says that a worker is a perpetrator, one who causes something else or someone who initiates a wrong thing. So we're to be wary of those who are hired to preach another gospel. In Galatians 1:6, the Apostle Paul writes in Galatians 1:6, when he's admonishing the church in Galatia, says, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. Verse 7, not that there is another one. In other words, there is only one true gospel. They're just perverting it. So not that there is another one, but there are some who trouble you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. Well, we see that all around us. Just look at the Christmas and Easter Christians and those who practice the pagan holidays. Verse 8, but even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to the one we preach to you, let him be accursed. Why would he say an angel from heaven? What happened to one third of those? They followed Satan and were cast down. So we can't be tricked by the demons, and we don't want to be tricked by false preachers. It says, let him be accursed. Verse 9, as we've said before, and I say again, If anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to the one you received, let him be accursed. Now, these are pretty strong words from the Apostle Paul as he writes to the church and the congregation in Galatia. Paul boldly states, don't accept a false gospel. So the third warning, the summary of point three, beware of evil workers, and I put in parentheses, those who are paid to draw you away from God. The fourth warning of the apostles, in Philippians 3:2, we're right back at that verse. There's the next warning is beware of the concision. Beware of the concision. Thayer's lexicon explains that the concision is a reference by the Apostle Paul, who boast about their righteousness, that their circumcision as a Jew makes them better than other people. Of course, the Jews were circumcised, and that differentiated them from the Gentiles, who were referred to then as uncircumcised. But boasting about your righteousness is like putting up a sign that says Honest John's Car Sales. If you have to put up a sign that says you're honest, that's basically telling everyone that there is some question to your honesty and you're trying to straighten it out. Similarly, if we go about telling others how righteous we are, that in itself isn't very righteous. We don't go around saying, oh, yoo-hoo, look at me, I fast and pray. Well, in Luke 18, in verses 11 and 12, we have that example. In Luke 18, verses 11 and 12. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, and even this tax collector. I fast twice a week, I give tithes of all I possess. It's a pretty bold statement. Well, our relationship with his God, we need not compare ourselves with other men, noting that we fast or a prayer tithe in a superior manner to others. Now, there's another way to look at this, and it's explained in Matthew 6 and verse 1, about not doing your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them, otherwise you won't have your reward in heaven. And then it goes on in verse 2, in Matthew 6 and verse 2, do not sound a trumpet before you as hypocrites in the synagogues and the streets. And first, when I read this when I was much younger, how many people have somebody going in front of them and sounding a trumpet? Ta-da, I'm arrived, I'm here. That's not what it's referring to. What they're referring to, the trumpet in this case, if you want to think of a tuba, a big brass tuba that's setting on its side, they had a brass container at the temple. When people came into the temple, that's where they made their offering. Now, if you can imagine, the coming into the temple, and there's this big brass container, and people are coming in. Well, what's it going to sound like? Okay, people are dropping their coins in a brass trumpet, as it were, and you can imagine this as the coins drop. The brass is going to sound with the clanging of the coin, thus drawing attention to the ones that have more coins than somebody else to make it. And it says, don't be doing that sort of thing. That's not the way to live as a Christian. And so if you just drop the coin in the middle where it didn't make a sound, the offering would be complete that you were making. It's a similar situation with prayer. If we look in Matthew 6, we just read a few verses down in verse 5. And when you pray, you shall not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues or on the corners of the streets, that they may be seen by men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. First time I ever saw a street preacher was in Seattle. I was younger then, and I was there on a business trip in near downtown Seattle, and there was a street preacher standing on a box. And he was really giving it the what for. He felt compelled to do that in public, whether he was preaching, prophesying, or praying. And he felt to do that. And I thought, wait a minute, didn't I read something about this in Matthew? And sure enough, here we are. In Matthew, we read on in verse 6, But you, when you pray, go into your room, and when you've shut your door, pray to your Father who's in the secret place. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. And when you pray, don't use vain repetitions as the heathen do, for they think that they will be heard by their many words. Therefore, verse 8, do not be like them, for your Father knows the things you have need of before you ask. So, just saying the same thing over and over again doesn't make you righteous, doesn't make for effective prayer. And if we read on, then Jesus Christ went on to provide a model prayer, what you should do, how you should pray. So we're not to go out on the street corner or loudly pray in public so that people can see how righteous we are. Well, who or what are is the concision? Those who portend to be righteous, but in their hearts, they're arrogant. Remember what God hates? In Proverbs 6:16, there are seven things that God lists that he hates. And the first thing on that list of seven things is a proud look. God isn't happy with arrogance, with an arrogant approach as we worship him. We are warned to avoid the example of those who think that they are righteous by their deeds. We have this reinforced in Matthew 23 and verse 27. In Matthew 23 and verse 27, where Jesus was chastising the Pharisees and the scribes, he says, "Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, outwardly appearing beautiful, but within are dead people's bones and all uncleanness. Pretty on the outside, not so pretty on the inside." It's the heart or the attitude that God looks upon. And we're to be thankful for what God has given us. And we don't need to be self-righteous about what God has given us. So point four is beware of the concision, or parentheses, avoid arrogance. The warning number five, beware of being spoiled by men using philosophy and vain deceit. In Colossians 2 and verse 8, we read this full verse in Colossians 2 and verse 8. Here we have this fifth beware. Beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit after the tradition of men, after the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ. But we say, well, I know what I believe. I follow God. No one's going to trick me. And you know what? You may be absolutely correct. And I hope you are, and I hope you're strong. But we're all subject to the seduction or temptation that can creep upon us unawares. In Matthew 24:24, Jesus gave that warning to us about what could happen, even though we think that we're strong. In Matthew 24:24, Jesus said, "For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect." So there's going to come a time, false prophets, false Christs, showing great signs and wonders. And when it says, even the elect, the original King James Version has the term very elect. In other words, a select few. And the term, when used, if possible, suggests that it may be possible for us to be deceived unless we are then at one with Christ. The letters to the churches of in the book of Revelation show us the challenges that we face. The churches that we've discussed in the past, pictured in Revelation, were actual church congregations. However, the written scripture that we have in our hands that was preserved for our use today is list these churches. So the message is to us, not just to them, and that we're all subject to the same challenges by those church congregations. In Revelation 2 and verses 1 through 7, I'm just going to first, it talks about the angel to the church of Ephesus and gives description, and goes down to verse 6 and tells about things that were good. Verse 6, yet this you hate the works of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. So there's something good here. He says They have some positive things and they have some negative things, but he grants that they hate the works of the Nicolaitans. And he says, I hate them. So who are these Nicolaitans? They're only mentioned twice in the Bible, both times in Revelation 2. The church of Ephesus is praised because they hate the deeds of the Nicolaitans just as God hates their works. But it isn't just the deeds of the Nicolaitans that are condemned. In Revelation 2 and verse 12, and to the angel of the church in Pergamum write, and it goes on, verse 15, so also some have held, or some who hold to the teachings of the Nicolaitans. So this doctrine of the Nicolaitans was held by some members of the congregation of God's church in Pergamum. And God calls on those to hold a false doctrine to repent. Well, those are pretty bold statements to the churches at Ephesus and Pergamum. God hates the deeds of the Nicolaitans and the doctrines of the Nicolaitans. But if God feels so strongly about the Nicolaitans, maybe we should take a look at just what were the doctrines and deeds of the Nicolaitans. Now, where did we start out here? Let's go back to the verse in Colossians 2, verse 8. Beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit, after the tradition of men, after the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ. In the case of the church at Ephesus, the congregation was praised for hating the deeds of the Nicolaitans. In contrast, the next letter was to the church at Pergamum, showing that some of the people, not only they did not hate the deeds of the Nicolaitans, but they held to beliefs that practiced the doctrine of the Nicolaitans. Bear in mind that all of the Bible then was written down for our benefit, so we can see both letters so that we could better learn and understand the plan of God. So what was so bad about the deeds and doctrines of the Nicolaitans that we should be concerned about today? There are commentaries and Bible dictionaries and secular research that into the Nicolaitans about their deeds and doctrines. I want to make sure that I pronounce that word correctly, because I went on YouTube and I how to pronounce this word. And I came upon a YouTube that says a variety, or here's a number of people pronouncing Nicolaitans. And they played a couple of public television preachers, and then on came Darris McNeely of the Beyond Today, and they had him. And the next guy was Ben Light, who's a pastor out in Salem, Oregon. And they went on with other people who had videos that they had captured. And they were all saying Nicolaitans. There's a lot of other ways to pronounce the word. But the commentaries and Bible dictionaries go on to give us some idea about them. The Smith Bible Dictionary says that the answer is right there in the adjoining verses, that some of the people in the congregations were seduced by false doctrine. They were committing spiritual fornication by wandering away from the truths of God. In Revelation 2, verse 14, that preaching, or the verse 14, just before the verse that talks about the teaching of the Nicolaitans, it says, few things I have against you, the teaching of Balaam, that eating food sacrificed to idols and practicing sexual immorality. So we get an idea of what those Nicolaitans were doing. Now take a look at the church in Thyatira in Revelation 2:18. And it, again, right after this, it says, my servants commit sexual immorality and eat things sacrificed to idols. And I gave her time to repent of the immorality, and she did not repent. Now, Strong's word that they use, G4203, fornication, means given, in a metaphorical sense, given to idolatry or to worship idols. That's the fornication. Leaving faithfulness from God and going to the dark side. Okay, that's what they're calling is fornication. So there's a striking similarity to the letters of those three churches in Revelation 2. And in each case, there's a reference to fornication. But the context shows the reference is largely about spiritual fornication, wandering away or being drawn away from the truths of God. Well, there are only two references in the Bible to Nicolaitans, and they're included with statements about spiritual fornication. Other historical researchers show the relationship between the deeds and doctrines of the Nicolaitans are those who are influenced by what we call Gnosticism. Now, Gnosticism is, that's G-N-O-S-I-S, based on Gnosis. Gnosticism is a worldview or belief that predates Christianity. It's based on the notion that there is a flawed creation and a flawed creator, and that we're all designed to suffer unless we lock into the harmony of the universe. I think what now we call it the Age of Aquarius, I think. I made that up, I don't know, but it smells right. The ancient Greeks practiced forms of Gnosticism. Indeed, Gnosis is the Greek word for knowledge. The idea that knowledge, meaning apart from God, will actually bring us to a higher spiritual plane and to paradise, as apart from God, is clearly false. The Gnostic influence is alive today through various religions and movements, and even in our educational system. And really, we can explore the whole Gnosticism and its influence on Christianity, perhaps in another message. But the doctrines and the deeds of the Nicolaitans are just some of the ways we can be deceived and drawn away from God. The bottom line of the Apostle Paul's warning in Colossians 2:4 about beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit, after the tradition of men, after the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ, really sums that up for number 5. Beware of being spoiled by philosophy and vain deceit. The next warning we get is in Hebrews 3:12. In Hebrews 3:12, the sixth warning is beware of an evil heart of unbelief. In Hebrews 3:12, we read, beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. That's a pretty blunt warning. The caution is to be careful not to develop unbelief that will cause you to depart from the true God. This is called, then, an evil heart. Turning away from God is surprisingly common. People blame God for their own mistakes. And then they think, God must be the evil one. God hates me. Therefore, I'm an innocent person suffering because God doesn't love me. And it often happens slowly at first. Maybe something bad happens. We don't really know what causes it. Or perhaps we're in denial or blind to our own sins. And then the consequences of our sins might be multiplied by a bad attitude and denial that we had anything to do with it. Oh, no, it just happened somehow. I hear that a lot among students. I didn't do anything. Well, then why did lightning strike you 3 times? You know, I mean, there's something wrong here. And when people can't find anyone else to blame, then they blame God, because God must hate them, or that bad thing wouldn't have happened. After all, they're convinced in their own mind that they're innocent. Well, this is a satanic ruse, a trick that is played upon in the mind to draw us away from God. In James 4, we read that humility cures worldliness. In James 4, to quote James 4, verse 7, therefore submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Well, if we want to not have an evil heart of unbelief, what do? We have it right there. Submit to God and resist the devil, and the devil will flee from us. So resisting satanic impulses will help us submit to God and draw us close to him. Because the devil doesn't want to get close to God. He worries about that. Therefore, the closer we are to God, the more difficult it will be for Satan to draw us away from God. So point 6 is beware of an evil heart of unbelief. We don't want to start off by unbelieving one little thing and then another little thing and then blame God for the bad consequences of our unbelief. And the warning number 7. Beware lest you fall from your own steadfastness, led away with error of the wicked. That's a long one. It's shortened up if we go to 1 Corinthians 10:12. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. 1 Corinthians 10:12. So the warning that we're going to read in 2 Peter, that the Apostle Peter gave in 2 Peter 3, 16 and 17, has those words, "Beware lest you also fall from your own steadfastness, being led away with the error of the wicked." We're really talking about is people who think that they're pretty solid. They pretty well got it together. They're standing on firm ground. And so, therefore, they're in good shape. Nothing's going to happen to them. Jesus himself gave the example of the house built on a rock in Matthew 7, verses 24 through 27. And he said, "A wise man builds his house on a rock," meaning a firm foundation. And he goes on to say that when the winds blow and the rains come and the floods come, house is still there, didn't get washed away. But the foolish man, in verse 26, builds his house on the sand. And the rains descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and the great was its fall. So the foundation is pretty important. It was many years ago, in 1961, my dad built a silo on the farm. Big round silo for putting in corn next to the dairy barn. And they were digging. I was shorter then. And I watched as the backhoe came out and they dug a big circle in the ground to put a footing in for the silo. And 3/4 of the circle was nice clay bottom. And 1/4 of it, they hit a sand pocket. Well, this was interesting, because if you build your house and one corner is on the sand and you're going to put many tons in a silo, in a tower, what's going to happen to that silo at some point? It's going to tilt. So they reached and they dug and they dug and they dug that sand. It was fine beach sand. I don't know how many thousands of years old it would be that there happened to be fine beach sand buried under Midwestern prairie soil. But it was there, and they dug that out, and they put rocks in. Then they put in a foundation and a footing. And for all the care that they did, the silo is still there today, built in 1961. And if you take a look at the silo now, and how many years has that been? What, 62 years? And if you take a look next to the barn, nice and straight, and you take a look at the silo, there's a slight tilt to that silo today, just ever so much, that over time, like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Now, nobody could tell at a glance, but you could see that even despite the early efforts that to make sure that it was built on stone, on a firm foundation, that it wouldn't wash away. And of course, you've probably seen beaches. We had some years ago, there was, just after the feast, my daughter and son-in-law were down on the Gulf of Mexico coast. And a hurricane came through, and some reporter said, well, he would anchor his news jeep to a big post that was in the on the beach. It wasn't going to get blown away or washed away. He chained it to that post. And when the storm was over, there was no post and there was no jeep. It was gone. Daughter said the news guy was in the motel room next to them, taking video of the tornado going over the Gulf, and it was a water tornado because it had pulled down and sucked up the water. All very exciting stuff. But I remember that the vehicle was gone, the post was gone, and I thought about building on a sand. Probably not. So beware lest you fall from your own steadfastness. You think you got solid, you better double check. The 1 Corinthians 10:11 we quoted, "Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." This warning number 7 is really about humility. We have to recognize that we are all potentially vulnerable to the error of the wicked. Any one of us could be susceptible to the wiles of the devil. And if we say, well, such and such would never happen to me, well, that's why the Apostle Paul issued the warning. He said, you know, take heed. And if people refuse to follow God, then they often unknowingly, and it just could be a little thing, and then it gets more and more, then they often unknowingly embrace the wicked one, the Satan who actively opposes God. So it starts out little, I could never be swayed, but then they buy into one little thing, and that's just, yeah, maybe I disagree with that. The Bible just didn't quite get it right, you know, and I know better. And so for one must be careful. So the summary of point 7 about the warning, beware lest you fall from your own steadfastness. So we've gone over the bewares of the apostles. First of all, we covered beware of what the prophets are saying. Be mindful, because they said it for a reason. It's for us to read. The second one is beware of dogs, meaning a man of impure mind, an impudent man. Third is beware of evil workers, those who are paid to go against what God says. Fourth is beware of the concision. In other words, beware of those who flaunt their supposed righteousness. Because if they tell you how righteous they are, that ought to be a pretty big sign. Number five, beware of being spoiled by men using philosophy and vain deceit. Oh yeah, that sounds pretty good, until it isn't. So you've got to be able to balance it with the truths from the Bible. The sixth warning of the apostles, beware of an evil heart of unbelief. Ooh, can all start out very little, and then you get doubtful. Once the seeds of doubt are sown, it takes people away from God. And warning number 7, beware, take heed lest you fall from your steadfastness. I say that. What is it? The higher they rise, the harder they fall in some of those cases. So be careful in that regard. Well, the apostles followed in Christ's footsteps, and those apostles' words were inspired by God. They were written in the Bible for our benefit. So just as we pay attention to the warnings issued by Christ, so we should then follow the warnings issued by the apostles. Those warnings are for our benefit to stay safe, be happy, and enjoy our future in the family of God.